KHJ Los Angeles.
Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recording.
Welcome to the 11th episode of the Functional Nerds. We are the guys who like to sit around and talk about Apple computers, science fiction and fantasy stuff, music and video games and comic books and all that kind of great stuff. And then we, as we're talking about that stuff, we just record it for you, the listener, which is kind of cool. We're cool guys, right, John?
I suppose it's all relative, really, you know.
kind of like art.
Yes. Yeah.
It's all subjective.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, my name is Patrick Hester. I am an author, a blogger, a podcaster, a marketing director who has a trade show early tomorrow morning. And we do this every week, myself and John Anilio. Say hello, John.
Hello, I'm John Anilio of the Sci-Fi Songs. I have a blog, scifisongs.blogspot.com, where I post lots of free music. You can also buy music too, but there's a lot of free music there based on science fiction and fantasy books and TV shows and movies and that kind of stuff.
Can you buy the free music, or is that just, you know, silly?
Well, the album, I think you could really find all that stuff for free on my site somewhere. So yes, you can buy the free music. Although I've been thinking a lot about that lately and how to do other things with my stuff. But anyway, that we don't need to get into that now. But I'm also
foreshadowing.
Well, I guess of a kind. But anyway, so I'm the other half of the Functional Nerds with Patrick. And most recently, we've been having a third nerd every week, and it's been great. And we've really been enjoying doing that. And I think it's really added quite a lot to the show to have a third voice on here. And this week we have blogger and writer Andrew Liptak. Andrew, why don't you say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, hello. I guess, yeah, blogger is probably more accurate. I write for my own site, but I've also contributed to IO9 and SF Signal on various matters about science fiction, usually military sci-fi or ongoing space policy. I've recently graduated with a master's degree in military history out of Norwich University, and I'm just, you know, write about pretty much whatever on my site.
So IO9, are you telling
yes.
me you're from the future?
I'm not at liberty to actually say. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe I'm from the past.
You know, I saw two articles on IO9. One was absolutely deriding the end of Lost. And the next one was saying how much they loved the end of Lost. So I was really confused.
I actually haven't seen Lost yet, the ending yet. So I haven't read those. But I think what they do is they've got a couple people talking about it and a couple people with different opinions. As far as I know, I haven't written for them for a little while. The last post I did was probably back in March.
Yeah. Yep. What was that about?
That one was called, if I remember correctly, it was Your Military Science Fiction Isn't Military Science Fiction. And it basically took some of the more mainstream military sci-fi books to task about, you know, what's wrong with them as far as actual military side of things. My basic idea behind it was that, well, they've got the military in them, but that doesn't really make them military science fiction. They're more about other things besides the military. They're not about warfare per se. They're more about, you know, how do people react? Like an example of the Forever War, how do people react when all of a sudden, you know, society is blowing right past them and changing? Starship Troopers is more of sort of a World War II analogy, and how that doesn't really line up with how warfare might really be fought in the future.
And you know what? That kind of brings us to our first topic. So, you know, I want to cut you off because we're going to be talking about that anyway.
Sure.
So why don't we just set it up for people?
Okay.
Because there are tons of different kinds of sci-fi. out there. There's a little bit of something for everybody. There's you know, what you consider the hard sci-fi, cyberpunk, alternate history, which is like the turtle doves kind of write that stuff. Apocalyptic, so tons of zombies. Space opera, which I would throw Dune into the space opera category. And then there's the military sci-fi, which is something that you like to talk about a lot. Some of our favorite authors are known for their military sci-fi, and you might disagree with this list, depending, you know, or at least it sounds like you might disagree with this list. But I was looking up some stuff, and, you know, you've got C.J. Shara, Orson Scott Card, and John Scalzi all are considered to be military science fiction authors. Where do you start? I mean, if is there like... Is there light military sci-fi and medium military sci-fi and really hardcore? How do you dip your toe into this genre?
Well, Orson Scott Card and John Scalzi anyone else like that. I mean, they're certainly military sci-fi books. I mean, there's really no getting away from that. If you look at it one way, they've got the military in them. They pretty much fall into the categories. You've got guys with power armor killing bugs and aliens and all sorts of things. Yeah, that's sort of where that falls. So John Scalzi is a really great place to start. Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game is absolutely fantastic. Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers is also really, really good. And so I kind of want to get away from these guys sort of really don't know what they're talking about. They do. They're just based on my training and my background as a military historian, there's a lot of different ways to look at warfare. And the idea that I approached with a couple of the articles and writings that I've done is that there's very different ways to study military history basically there's sort of a theoretical side to military. And then there's a sort of the fun and exciting version.
Sure.
And the fun and exciting version is the one that sells more books.
Well, and you mentioned Scalzi, and I read Old Man's War, and I loved it. I was also happy to see it get a product placement on Stargate Universe.
I saw that. Yeah, I thought that was great. Yeah, a slight aside, Patrick, I actually was able to watch that, not on iTunes, because nice. I found that. Well, I found out on my cable, I have cable vision. You know, they have like the on-demand stuff.
Yeah.
We always end up watching the on-demand stuff. Like my son's 4, so it's like it's a lot of like Blue's Clues and, you know, kids shows on the on-demand, you know.
Yeah.
But I was just, as I was there putting on Blue's Clues, I noticed like, oh, they have other, because like even like months ago, any of the free on-demand stuff was very limited. It was essentially some kids shows and some other stuff. And I noticed like, oh, wait a minute, it says prime time. And I noticed like, oh, Flash Forward. They have episodes of Flash Forward. That's awesome. And then I'm like, wait a minute. And then I looked around and I found the Sci-Fi Channel and I find that they have Stargate and they'll actually put it up like the next day, I guess. So I was psyched because I was able to watch it and I didn't have to buy it. And it was in HD, which it's not on Hulu when you watch Stargate Universe on Hulu. It's certainly not HD. So I was psyched. I was able to watch it in HD, and I'll watch the rest of the season on that because it was much better. But I was like, really, and I knew because I think I saw in one of the blogs that they had like a little still of like the guy reading.
Here's the thing, and I'm sorry, Andrew, we're kind of getting off track a little bit. When I saw Old Man's War, I hit pause. Uh-huh. And I rewound a little bit on my TiVo, and I got the shot, and I took it with my camera, with my iPhone. And I posted it to Twitter, and I commented, you know, I put at Scalzi on there so he would see it in his reply. And he took that picture and he put it on his blog.
Oh, really? It's your picture?
It's my picture. And I even posted a comment on there. I'm like, dude, that's my picture. And he replied to me and he's like, yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't have time to give you credit, but it's definitely your picture.
Wow, that's awesome. Are you mad that he didn't give you credit?
Hell no. I was like, dude, my picture's on Scalzi's website. That's cool.
Yeah, I didn't. No, it's okay, Andrew. I didn't realize that was your. I saw that picture. I don't know if it was on Scalzi's. I might have saw it on another website too.
It's probably traveling all over the place by now.
Yeah, you're famous.
You have credit for it now, actually. I'm looking at the webpage right now, and it actually has screen cap taken by Patrick Hester.
Nice. He's a nice guy. He rocks.
Yeah. Well, you know, let me ask you something, Andrew. Just to you said you have a master's degree in military history.
That's correct.
Yeah. Now, what made you, you know, just to get a little bit of background about you, what, you know, got you interested in doing that? Did you do any time in the military? Like, do you have family in the military? Is it just an interest of yours? What kind of motivated you to spend that much of your life getting a degree in military history?
It wasn't too bad. I decided to get a degree in history from Norwich University in Northfield, Vermont, which is the first private military academy in the United States, and it's actually the school that founded the ROTC program. I went there as a civilian. I've actually never been in the military, but I got my degree in history from there, and I did my final thesis on the Norwich University cadets or alumni who fought at Operation Overlord, which was the invasion of Normandy in 1944. Mm. Once I graduated college, I went back to my job at a bookstore and then got a job with back at Norwich at the School of Graduate Studies. And through them, I was able to get a degree. And the only degree that they offer in really my field that within my interest was military history.
Okay.
So I was working for the same program I was taking a degree in. So it was, you know, as far as a business practice, I can now really help my students, with our assignments. I don't teach. I'm just one of the administrators, but I can sort of walk them through and sort of translate what their instructors tell them and calm them down when they get mad. The military stuff, it was actually something I tried to avoid when I was in college, because at a military school, everybody loves Band of Brothers, everybody loves Saving Private Ryan, and I really didn't like, I didn't like Saving Private Ryan very much, but I liked Band of Brothers. So I was, you know, I wanted to sort of go more towards the social aspect of things, and it just sort of fell into my lap. So that's where that came from, and then while taking the degree, that's when I really got sort of rekindled an interest in writing, and it really changed how I thought about science fiction and, writing and things in general. It's really been I'm a little biased, but it was a fantastic program for me anyway.
Yeah. Now we had mentioned Orson Scott Card and John Scalzi, and who, who are some of the authors that you would consider, like you were saying, how you don't necessarily have to view those other authors as military sci-fi. Who would you consider, which authors would you consider to be military sci-fi? Like if you had a really, you know,
hardcore,
well, maybe not super hard, but just someone like, if you were going to define, if looked up military sci-fi in the dictionary, who would be some of the authors you would see there, you think?
Well, I'd include Scalzi, and I'd include Robert Heinlein, and some of the other, Orson Scott Card. But if I was to pick what I would think of as one of the better sort of military sci-fi books, I'd actually pick Dune.
Arrakis, Dune, wasteland of the Empire. And the most valuable planet in the universe. Because it is here, and only here, where spice is found.
Why did we come here, Father?
Really?
Herbert's classic, yeah. Mainly because this is the crux of my argument, is that it's not the action that defines the military sci-fi element, it's the world building around the conflict in general. So you have characters or organizations that move towards warfare. What I find more realistic is what are the conditions that bring about people to go fight one another? And Dune is a good example, because you have all these political elements to it. You have the House Harkonnen and House was it Arcady? No,
Atreides. You have Atreides and Harkonnen, or Harkonnen.
Yeah, and so the and then you have Paul going to the planet, becoming a messiah, rallying people around a almost a religious element. There's a bigger religious element, actually, inspired by Islam.
Well, there's tons of religious themes to Dune anyway.
Yeah, and I mean the basic and something I mentioned in this IO9 article a while back is that warfare is incredibly complicated, and it's more than just one person picking up a gun and shooting somebody. There's according to some of the military theorists, if you go from a European school of thought, it's basically trying to bend another person to your will, or bend an organization to your will. And essentially, if you go by that school of thought, warfare is an extension of policy. So when you add that element onto it, it sort of brings warfare into a much different focus than something like what you might see in the movies, like Avatar, or any of the other or Aliens.
You keep mentioning Starship Troopers, you know, and I've heard, sure. I have never read the book, but I've seen the movie, and yeah. I know that a lot of people hated the movie if they read the book.
That's one I'd like to see remade as a movie. Starship Troopers is an interesting one, and that one actually does get a lot of the points right, and it has a nice balance between sort of some action and sort of the soldier side of things.
Well, and then you had the shower scene.
I think he's talking about the book, Patrick.
I'm talking about the book.
Oh, darn. Damn.
But the thing that's really missing out of Starship Troopers, I thought, was that you don't have the sort of the political side of things. You don't have, you have basically a race of humans and a race of buggers. No, that's Ender's Game. You've got the bugs attacking them. There's not really, there's a sort of, when I read it, there's a bit of a disconnect, especially after I completed my degree. It was sort of, there's a disconnect there in between, how an organization goes to war there.
So you were looking for more political intrigue part of it.
I was looking for more realistic world building. Basically, instead of, and then they fight. I would say, why do they fight? looking for the reasons behind it. And don't get me wrong, I love Starship Troopers. It's got a lot of good action. But the other element that I sort of took Starship Troopers to task. I got a lot of people emailed me really angry about this. But Robert Heinlein is a product of World War II. He was he was involved with the U.S. military. I don't remember exactly to what extent, but he worked with Isaac Asimov with the U.S. Army, I think. And Starship Troopers is essentially, it takes a lot of elements of World War II, what was popular then and what was very dramatic, such as airborne military tactics. You basically take soldiers, you put them into armor, and you drop them behind enemy lines. It's a great concept. It has a lot of kind of very visual, exciting action to it. But in my mind, I read it from another point of view. It's not really that realistic, because if you have airborne soldiers, they're not likely to be heavily armed. And if you can miniaturize things to a suit of armor, miniature nuclear bombs and armor and guns and things, you have people on the ground who are probably going to be keyed with defenses against that sort of thing. That, what doesn't have to be miniaturized is going to be much more powerful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you're talking about Halo.
In a way. Halo certainly, Starship Troopers certainly inspired a lot of stuff there. I imagine Halo took a, well, Halo borrows from everything. It borrows from Ringworlds, Aliens, the whole nine yards.
Well, sure. And you got like in Old Man's War, spoiler alert people, but you've got, genetic engineering in order to make the better soldier that you drop behind enemy lines.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main thing is that you warfare usually acts in sort of stages. You have a defense will be made for anything that any sort of action that is or any sort of weapon or personnel change that's put into use. So going all the way back to the military revolution, when you had the introduction of cannons in the battlefield, the next step was just to build better fortifications. They built better cannons and bigger fortifications. And I imagine a very similar thing would happen. You put armor onto guys, drop them to the field, well, the enemy is eventually going to find out something that will defeat it. And we're seeing that now in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, what you've got soldiers running around with robots on the ground, little tread things with treads and cameras. All they need to do is send a kid with a can of spray paint out, and you can disable it.
you send Donna's grandfather Wilfred out, or Wilf out, with a paint gun to shoot the Dalek's eye stalk.
You will come with me.
Will I, Ick?
My vision is not impaired.
Blinded. <I'm- coughs> Sorry, it was in Doctor Who. But it's the same concept. Paintball in the eye stalk stops the Dalek. Of course, the Dalek says, "You know, you're stupid, and I'm just gonna take that off, and now I'm gonna kill you."
Exterminate.
When you know, obviously, a lot of this stuff is inspired by people's experiences, just like you said. Heinlein, you know, was inspired by World War II. Tolkien was inspired by what was going on, you know, in the world around him when he was writing The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. You know, he saw the evacuation of London, you know, and the kids going out into the, you know, being taken out into the countryside to protect them, that kind of stuff. So, you know, he was a soldier
in World War I as well. He was in the trenches, and that was a pivotal thing for him.
But I'm wondering how many of our authors today have never seen any kind of, you know, they haven't seen that. We have our World War II veterans are few and far between now. I mean, they're that generation is passing. You've got the folks who were in the Korean War and the Vietnam War, you know, they're getting older and then not necessarily writing a lot of stories. So, you know, I'm curious, where do you think we're going from here as far as military sci-fi is concerned, now that we have a generation who, I mean, yeah, we've had the Iraq stuff and the Afghanistan stuff, but we haven't really had huge big wars.
Well, Vietnam inspired a bunch of things. I mean, the Forever War was directly inspired by that. There was, I mean, all you need to do now to really experience warfare is go onto YouTube and you can find clips from, you know, the ongoing combat.
That's not the same thing.
Well, something I've taken to, somebody said to me once is that art is inspired within the context of its creation. So something that you create back around World War II or in the post World War II era is going to be very different from anything that's created now. So. And I mean, you've got a lot of soldiers out there who there's nothing to say that a bunch of those guys won't come back and write on their experiences.
I would imagine they would. You know, I would think so. You know, there's enough, you know, military personnel out there now. I'm sure some of those guys are going to come back and write about their experiences. I believe. I think his name. I can't think of what his first name is, but I believe his last name is Acevedo. He wrote these like vampire books that are sort of like there's one that takes place in the Middle East. And I believe I could be wrong here, but I think he was military. I think he was in, you know, one of the early campaigns. So I know it's already happening. And, you know, you're talking about the Vietnam veterans with that. And I actually, one of the books that I wanted to bring up, which is I think would be considered a military sci-fi, and I'm bringing up Star Wars again, Patrick, like we seem to do every week these days. But there's a book, I don't know if either of you guys read it, it's called Jedi Trial, and it is like a Clone Wars novel, and it's written by David Sherman and Dan Craig. Have you guys read that one?
I have not read it.
Yeah.
I just saw it referenced on something, but I can't remember what.
Did you read it, Andrew, or...?
I did, and I think I didn't like it.
Okay. I mean, the only reason I bring that up is because I read it, and I remember liking it. I remember liking it enough. This is considered a Clone Wars novel. This came out prior to the third movie, because I, like many Star Wars dorks, you know, I didn't love the first two. I liked, Attack of the Clones a little bit better than the first one. But I
you was saying you didn't like it?
No, I didn't. Not so much. But and seeing sort of the clips for Revenge of the Sith before it came out, I bought into it. I was like, you know what? I'm gonna really try to enjoy this one, and it looks like it's gonna be better. And so I read a lot of the extended universe stuff that had come out in between the two movies. I'm like, I'm just gonna really try to get myself up for this. That's one of the ones that I read, and I don't know if I read a blog post about it or something, or if I read something about the authors about how maybe it was an interview with David Sherman or Dan Craig where they were talking about sort of their military background and about the kinds of things that would make a more realistic, military sci-fi book. I remember they were talking a lot about your opponent's like food and water supplies. I remember that was like a big thing in the book, and I just read like an outside thing with it. But what's your opinion? Obviously, you didn't really care for it very much. What's your thoughts on it?
Well, I thought it was very. I thought it was basically a soldier's book, and as I said, I tend to prefer the stuff on the much larger level. The more.
Oh, I see.
It was a fun read. I think I blew through it in about a day.
Uh-huh.
But David Sherman's actually U.S. He was a U.S. Marine during Vietnam, and he's written a number of other sci-fi books. I don't think I've read any of them, but as far as I could tell, there's a lot of stuff that was sort of it was very sort of in line with some of their other books. And I'm a little surprised that they haven't brought them back to do more. As far as a sci-fi book goes, I guess it's a Star Wars book that has a lot of fighting and Clone Wars and lightsabers, and so it's sort of par for the course, I guess.
Yeah, he's got a ton of books. I'm looking at his Wikipedia page right now, and he has a whole series called Starfist, and he's got a lot. It doesn't seem like he's got a lot recently.
Well, and Sherman was a Marine, and Craig looks like he was his.
By Michael Stackpole. Oops, sorry.
That was really weird. I didn't hear anything, and then all of a sudden I heard you both. It was kind of strange. I was just saying, Sherman is a Marine, or was a Marine. Well, you're never not a Marine anymore. Dan Craig, it looks like they read a lot of books together. He was in the Army.
Yeah.
They were both in Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Craig became a Sergeant Major. I don't see a rank for Sherman here. But anyway, that looks like they do have a ton of books, John.
Yeah. No, I mean, but I liked that one book, but I think I see what you're saying, Andrew, in terms of you want to see more of what goes into making, one party declare war on another. Like, what drives one group of people to do that? I mean, because when you think of the, I don't know. I mean, I know as a species, there is that, fight or flight thing, and there's the, protecting your thing. Yeah, but there's excuse me. There's all of this kind of feelings within us, but when you think of particularly in like a civilized world, what makes someone or a government or what have you commit that much life and, manpower and money and all that stuff to go to war. So I think I hear what you're saying, Andrew. Is like that is the interesting question. Like what is driving that?
Yeah. And see, I would suggest that while that's important, what is going to make the book appeal more is going to be that soldier.
Yep, it's the blood and the guts and the powered armor and the nuclear bombs and the guns and.
Well, not necessarily. It's not necessarily. It's the arc of that character,
sure.
And it's what that character is going through. I mean, that's true of anything.
Yeah. Well,
if you don't have the character, I mean, no one's going to read the book. It's not going to be compelling.
Yeah, I think there's room for both. I went to PhilCon, that science fiction convention in Philadelphia. I guess it was in November. And I sat in on a couple of panels where Cory Doctorow was speaking, and he wasn't talking about military science fiction. He was just talking about writing in general. but science fiction particularly. And about he gave the he sort of had this sort of metaphor, and I'm probably screwing it up a little bit, but it's essentially how in a good story, in a good science fiction story, and I think this is sort of our relationship between like the soldier story or the character story or the main character, whoever, and Andrew's talking about, you know, the big picture of things, like the big thing. And Patrick, you're talking about the arc of the individual character. And Cory Doctorow had sort of made this analogy of like it's sort of a small gear turning a larger gear. Meaning
microcosm versus macrocosm.
Yeah, exactly. About how if it's a really good story.
You made those words up.
No, I did not. I learned that in high school.
But it's about how whatever the character is going through on a personal level should sort of be echoed in what's going on in the world of that story on a bigger level. And if you can, I mean, I think that's probably what makes a great story is when those two things can sort of mirror each other and echo each other. So yeah, I think that's ultimately what you want in a story is you want those big things and you want those little things. And if one, you know, you can have a good book that kind of focuses on one more than the other, but I think if you can really, as a writer, if you can really put both of those out there and really, really make it, and that's probably the challenge of being a good writer is finding a way to have those two things complement each other.
Story is key, and if you can't see me from where I am, but I'm nodding very fast. My ideal book would be if you could mesh some of these larger strategic and overview elements with a good character story. That's what you will that will make a good sort of military science fiction, but one that will really deal with, you know, a lot of these issues that I mentioned. And you know, there are books out there that do this. I mean, I'm not saying that all science fiction is not like this. That's certainly not the case.
Cool. All right, well, maybe perhaps we can move on to our next topic. Patrick, why don't you, kind of get us going on our next topic a bit.
All right, well, since Andrew is not only a military historian, but he also has studied and written about the space program, I wanted to talk a little bit about NASA because it's been a couple of rough years for NASA. As we all know, the Space Shuttle Atlantis is currently on its last mission. Budget cuts and a new administration have put NASA's plans for future manned spacecraft kind of in flux. They're not sure what they're going to do. And now the Mars rovers and the lander, though they've been doing great and they've gone long beyond their original mission specs, they're fading now. I think the lander actually has died. The future of the U.S. space program, it's really up in the air, which could mean that anything is possible or that, you know, we're looking at a 21st century version of the Dark Ages as far as space travel is concerned. And the United States may take a back seat to other space agencies in other countries. Andrew, you've written a lot on the space industry. I'd just like to hear what you think about all this and where you think we're heading.
Depending on what I say, I'm going to get a lot of people annoyed at me. Some of my friends and I get into arguments about this all the time. Personally,
if I get an order at you, I just hang up.
Okay. Oh, no cookies for you. I'll recall my messenger who is hopefully has not eaten them yet. Well, there's a couple of ways to look at this. The space shuttle is... the Space Shuttle Atlantis that's up there right now, the first launched in 1985 when I was born. So it's as old as I am. And that's a long time for a piece of hardware to be operating.
You were born in 1985?
I was.
I feel so old.
And I've gotten people annoyed at me already.
I'm so old.
Well, they were. Don't worry. They were saying on the news today that, you know, life expectancy for people is about the 80s and 90s, and by the time that happens, you'll probably be able to live longer. So, fear not.
I plan to live forever.
But as far as the space industry right now is at a sort of crossroads, I think, and I think it's a little premature to say that we're about to enter dark ages. The Obama administration has recently released plans, and that they've been under a lot of criticism for it, and also by like astronaut Neil Armstrong for some of the plans that they have. The big thing is to scale back the Constellation project, which was designed to get people to the moon again.
With rockets. You know, I don't yes. mind pissing people off. Start over. Close NASA down. Start the next project. I'm tired of it. You're talking about Atlantis being ancient. You know, I remember Enterprise. NASA, they piss me off. They always do. I mean, they have some cool things, but for the most part, I mean, you're looking at they want to go back to rockets. Well, hell, rocket technology was part of the shuttle program. Where's the next level of technology? What the frack have you people been working on for the last 30 years? Where is it?
Well, rockets is the way to get into space. It's unfortunately, there's no repulsor lifts or anti-gravity drives. I mean, that's something that is, well, for all intents and purposes, science fiction. Rockets are a very good way to get into space. It's comparatively, the reason that they still use them for space shuttles, it's the alternative to, I guess, anything else. So,
have you ever ridden on Superman the Ride?
No.
Are you aware that was a concept to get a spacecraft into orbit without using rockets?
I was not.
It was designed to be a magnetic lift. Essentially, Superman the Ride is a car full of people being pushed and pulled by magnets along a track up into the sky, where they hang for a minute and essentially experience weightlessness. And then you slide back down the track.
It's essentially a rail cannon.
Yes, but with magnets.
Yep.
There's magnets on the cart. There's magnets on the track, and you've essentially got, you know, one magnet pulling the next, and then the next magnet is pushing to get away from, you know, opposites and all that kind of stuff. So you know, you're being pulled and pushed, and really fast, you skyrocket. I mean, it's the fastest damn ride I think I've ever been on. But the idea and the concept, the guy took it to NASA first, and he's like, look, here's this thing. It's really cool. It'll get you up into space. It'll cost you less money. And, you know, look how cool it is, blah, 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 blah. And NASA's like, we're not doing that. We're, you know, we know better than you do. We're smarter than you are.
Well, a couple of things to that. I'm not a scientist. I do the history stuff. The space program is intricately linked with the military-industrial complex, and my thesis at Norwich was actually a paper called "The Military Roots of Manned Spaceflight." Ever since the early 1900s, and even a little bit before that, a lot of scientists, rocket scientists, that from all over the world, saw rocket propulsion as a way to get into space, and eventually Wernher von Braun, the German military scientist, was able to do that right during the height of World War II, and he was a Nazi member of the Nazi Party.
Yeah.
Oh,
it sounds like to me that what you're talking about is how war can drive advances in technology.
In this instance, the drive was there. The funding was helped the scientists in this instance. During the Eisenhower administration, they actually created a civilian branch called NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and that had branched off from some other groups.
Right.
The events of the Cold War helped push that along. That's what sort of inspired people to take rocket, basically to put people onto the top of what, for all intents and purposes, was a missile system, and go into space. The original Mercury 7 astronauts, I have to give my hat is off to them. They are
Oh, yeah. They strapped a rocket between their legs and they launched him.
Built by the lowest bidding contractor, I might add.
Sure.
I have a feeling, as I said, I've never heard of the magnetic thing. I'm sure it's probably been looked at. I would say that the reason that the military, or that they used rockets, is, well, because that was the technology available. And it works. I mean, it's a very effective way to get into space. Sometimes they blow up, but Saturn V rocket had a million moving parts, and they all worked pretty well. As far as the future of spaceflight goes, though, that's still going to be carried over. Not to be like a pun, but it's still going to be carried on by rockets.
Russian rockets.
Russian at first, because they have the infrastructure in place. They have the Soyuz capsule. I don't remember what the rockets are called. But there is a budding private industry in the United States right now that is really making leaps and bounds.
We have the X Prize.
Well, the X Prize is sort of small potatoes when it comes to this. The company that I've been looking at very closely is something called SpaceX, and they're building what's called the rocket, the Falcon 9 missile, or sorry, not missile, the Falcon 9 rocket.
Oh, it'll be a missile.
Well, that's pretty much it. But they are the first private company to launch basically privately launch a satellite into orbit. And NASA has contracted with them to develop this Falcon 9 and the Dragon capsule, which will take people into space. So I think what the intent of the administration is to push things over to the private sector to help, you know, build up a fairly unique industry within the United States.
I kind of disagree a little bit. I think our administration right now has bigger problems, and what they're doing is they're trying to deal with the fact that, you know, I think a lot of people kind of feel frustrated that we spend the kind of money that we spend for NASA, and you know the common person doesn't necessarily see or perceive that they are receiving any benefits from that. You know,
according to a scientist I've heard, the amount of money that's actually spent on NASA is half a cent on the dollar for tax dollars. So the military spends far more. I think the problem is that there's a disconnect.
Perception.
There's a gap between what are they trying to achieve, and what are the practical gains out of that. And anybody who's read science fiction can probably list off a whole host of these things: mining asteroids, finding the moon.
Two things happen. NASA got stale, and their PR went in the toilet. And you know, now they can't even get in the 60s and 70s, if NASA was launching something, it was on every channel. Of course, there was only four channels, or three. Now, you know, they can't get 30 seconds on the news to talk about Atlantis launching.
There's a couple points to that, I think. You go from three channels to however many. I don't actually have TV at home, so I don't know how many channels you can get. But you can
100 billion.
Oh God, that's too many. But the focus is different. And again, looking at the 60s and 70s, you were in the middle of a Cold War when you had a lot at stake. I mean, and the interest in the moon missions fell off dramatically after Apollo 11. I mean, who can remember? Well, not very many people can remember who the pilots were, the astronauts on Apollo 12 and 14, right. 15, 16.
Oh, they don't know, and they don't know they don't know the names of the astronauts today. Yep. You know, find five people on the street who can tell you who's on Atlantis. You brought to mind something, and this is slightly off topic, but kind of still there. Talking about the Cold War, just not too long ago, a book came out. This is not fiction. This is true, that the Russians actually had spies in space, in space stations, or in little satellites. They actually put people up there. I think there was only a couple, but they actually talked about they had people sitting there in space in these little tiny satellites, and the satellites had guns in them so they could shoot other satellites if they came nearby. They never had to actually fire the weapons, but they did have KGB up there.
Yeah,
taking
I think
pictures.
I remember hearing about that. And the U.S. certainly had similar plans. I mean, the NASA wasn't the only people launching satellites up. I mean, you know,
that just tripped me out, though. I mean, I didn't realize that it had gone that far, and it's been kept a secret for like 30 years. They finally, like, someone went to Russia and did some research or something, and the KGB, they got into some files and found evidence that actually did happen, and they did actually have people up there, and that just tripped me out.
Really big backgrounds behind going to space was to prove that you could send a missile into space and drop it down accurately in Russia. The missiles that they're talking about are ICBMs. And satellites were an early thing that they tried to do. I know there's a lot that Eisenhower tried to propose an open skies policy, and the Russians didn't like that very much. So it doesn't come as any surprise that the Russians actually had spy satellites. I don't remember reading anything about the actual manned satellites, but it doesn't surprise me that much.
They had manned and we did not. We went the other route. You know, we just had the regular old spy satellites. Well, thanks to the wonderful world of the internet and Skype and networking, Andrew Liptak actually disappeared on us. Which kind of sucks, but hey, it happens. So we're going to end up cutting this a little bit shorter than we would have liked. Real quick, John, are you reading anything different? Are you still working on the Tad Williams book?
I'm still working on the Tad Williams book. It's great. It's still going. I'm still reading my comics. I'm reading another Green Lantern one, not Rebirth. I'm reading it's like the Secret Origin of Hal Jordan, about halfway through that. That's pretty good. So that's what I got going for reading. How about you? What are you reading these days?
I am still working on all I've been doing the graphic novel thing, which is actually, it's been working really well for me, and I've been doing the reviews online on atfmb.com. And I pushed through Doctor Who through Time and Space, Star Wars Legacy Volume 1 Broken, The Lone Ranger, which I thought was really neat. And then I have had this over a year, and I finally read it. Serenity, Those Left Behind, which was supposed to be a bridge between the TV show and the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just read that one, and I'm going to do a review on that here in the next week or so.
Cool.
So I've just kind of been doing that. And then I'm holding, if I reach over here, that is the box of Pyre books that I ordered.
Oh.
So those have just come in. Damn you, Lou Anders. So I've got those to read now as well.
Cool.
Heard your song. I liked your song, your collaboration with Dale.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Heard it on the hipster mm-hmm. Hip Tracks. What's it called? Hip Tracks.
Well, you heard it on Geek Dad Hip Tracks.
Yes,
which is one of Wired's many good podcasts. And
That was awesome. They talked about you and they talked about this podcast, and so I thought that was really neat. And it got me to listen to their podcast. So mission accomplished on their end. Thanks, guys.
And along with that, the Geek Dad Hip Tracks is hosted by Ken Denmead, who is the editor of the Geek Dad portion of the Wired magazine blog. He also has a book coming out called Geek Dad, which I hope to be getting my hands on pretty soon and talk about. And we will probably have Ken on as a guest
That kind of pisses me off.
What's that?
I'm not a dad. So, I mean, is this book going to appeal? Where's the Geek Uncle book?
I think it's totally usable for geek uncles too. I think the point of the blog, but particularly of this book, is sort of projects that you can do with your geeky children for like, you know, a weekend kind of project or a couple of hours project. And I'd have to look at it again, but we're talking like some pretty crazy stuff, like putting a like a camera, making sort of a little balloon and like flying it up like, you know, 100 feet or so, and then, you know, sort of videotaping stuff from airborne 100 feet in the air kind of stuff. So like really wow. cool geeky stuff. Yeah. So hopefully we'll be able to get Ken on. But actually the other host of the Hip Tracks podcast is Z, who has another podcast called Hipster Please and a blog where he knows everything about nerd music. And it's how I kind of
Nerdcore.
Yeah. And it's how I came into contact with Dale Chase, who I did my We Don't Need Another Trilogy song with. And we are going to have Z on our podcast next week. So we're very excited about that. And he is going to do a Nerdcore primer and sort of a geek music primer in general, talking a little bit about Filk and about guitar geek rock and all sorts of stuff. So we're really excited to have Z on next week. Z is a great podcaster.
Is that next week or the week after?
That would be next week.
It is next week. Okay.
Yes, it'll be June something, whatever, like June 3rd, I guess is when we're recording it.
I think we're recording it on the 2nd. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, whatever that Wednesday is that we're going to do that. So we're going to have Z on next week and talk about Nerdcore and some other things, and that should be a real cool show. Yeah. And to wrap up my bit of the plugs while we're here.
Yeah, you surreptitiously started pimping your stuff.
Oh yeah, didn't
well
didn't
done,
mean, but I did. Well you know, done. So you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/JohnAnelio, JohnAnelio. Did I just spell my name right? I hope I did. Anyway, and
he's tired, folks.
I am. And then scifisongs.blogspot.com, where you can get that track that I talked about with Dale for free. Also, if you just put John Anelio, JohnAnelio. Space Anelio. If you put that into Google, you'll get all my stuff first. There aren't really many Anelios because I sort of spell it phonetically, and that's what comes up. So you'll get my blog, and you'll get my Twitter, and you'll get my Facebook, and all that. So throw that into Google, and you'll find everything you need to know about me.
Yep. And if you go to page 2, you get to see the pictures that he didn't really want that Facebook released when they did their whole privacy thing.
I know, it's very embarrassing.
I like the ones from Cancun. Did not realize you could pull off a coconut bra.
I know. It's crazy. You know, it's funny. You mentioned embarrassing pictures. We were talking about age with Andrew, who is younger than us. Bastard.
I know, really.
Bastard. Anyway, I was saying one time, I think I tweeted this a while back about how a lot of the music that I first started listening to was, you know, sort of 80s rock and metal, which would be, you know, sort of the hair metal. Like I really love Def Leppard and all that kind of stuff. And I was saying how if I was about 2 or 3 years older, there would definitely be pictures of me in bands with with spandex. I like just missed it, which I'm really thankful for because when I first started getting into bands, like playing in a band in high school, like a rock band in high school, that is the year is about 91, 92. So grunge had already come in, and I hated grunge at the time. I hated Nirvana and I hated all that stuff. Like it killed my music. It's like, I want to listen to Whitesnake and Winger. I don't like this Nirvana crap. Of course, I've grown to like a little bit of that. But the thing that I will be forever grateful to Nirvana and Pearl Jam is that it made it okay to wear jeans and like a flannel shirt, which was certainly perfect. Well, I'm happy that my first pictures in a band are me in jeans and a flannel shirt and not spandex and teased hair, because if I was 2 years older, I'm sure I would have done it. I would have had it. It would have existed. So
I remember I was probably 12 years old, and my grandmother, we were living in Fresno, and she's like, we're going to San Jose to visit your aunt and uncle and your cousins. I'm like, okay. And she says, oh, and you're not supposed to know this, but I need you to dress up. Like, why do I need to dress up? She says, well, you're going somewhere and they don't want me to tell you, but I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to a concert. I'm like, I'm going to a concert? Why would I be going to a concert? Oh, your cousin Johnny, his band, they're playing, and so you have to go see him. It was a glam rock band. And I mean, they had the hair, they had the makeup, they had the whole deal. And I'm just sitting there, you know, of course, 12 years old, laughing my ass off at them and thinking, you know, how ridiculous they looked.
Yeah, I did a bunch of gigs with, you know, like I said, so my first gigs were when I was like 17 or 18 in some of the clubs in New Jersey. So bands that were a little bit older than me, even though, you know, Nirvana had crushed all that, there still were a lot of bands holding on to that. So I did a lot of gigs where we were like the opening act for like a band that was all spandexed and teased hair out, which was very funny. But yeah, no, I'm glad I did miss that. And the other thing, I am going to Balticon this weekend.
Yep.
Again, not to be confused
with Mer Lafferty.
So I'll be playing on that podcast, and that's pretty cool. And I finished that song for her. So there is a song called I Should Be Writing Now, which I'm going to play that night for the I Should Be Writing podcast.
Okay, hold on. I got to go back to one thing. You called the song We Don't Need Another Trilogy.
Okay.
And the only problem that I have with it is the title of the song, because every time you say we don't need another trilogy, I hear we don't need another hero.
Someone mentioned that, I think, in the comments too, or on Facebook or something.
Did they really? Oh, that's
yeah,
hilarious.
Bad. Like, oh, they said I should have like done it to that tune. To the, I should have like done like a Weird Al kind of a thing to that. But no, so I am going to be at Balticon. If you're at Balticon this weekend, please come and like, you know, come see me, or, you know, I really just, you know, contact me through Twitter or Facebook or through my email or whatever. And, you know, I'd love to meet up with some people. There's already a couple people that I'm going to try to meet up with. Kate Sherrod, our third nerd, is going to be there. So I hope to see her and hang out with her a little bit.
And you're going
to
record stuff, right?
You know, I haven't thought much about it because, like I said, my I have a big thing at work tomorrow, so I haven't really thought much about Balticon. But I'm sure once I get through everything tomorrow, Thursday will be very Balticon focused. So,
do you have a laptop?
I do. Yeah. So
yeah, just take it and record some stuff.
I have an actual like a Zoom H2 little digital recorder that I'll probably bring and just have with me because that records like very high quality, and I'll just maybe pull some people aside and talk to them a little bit. And
yeah, and then just shoot me the tracks.
That's the plan. And more podcast news. I'm also going to be I'm getting interviewed for the by Seattle Geekly. Do you know that podcast?
No.
They're quite a big podcast. They do a lot of nerdy stuff. They're obviously in Seattle. And they talk a lot about sort of the goings on in the Seattle scene. But they are just a great nerdy, geeky podcast. They talk about, you know, movies and gaming and all that kind of stuff. Some of the things that we do. Really nice. Shannon and Matt are the hosts of that. They've done some music things, and they emailed me a couple weeks ago and asked if I'd like to. They're doing like a music feature on a couple different like nerdy music acts. They've played my music a couple times, so they're going to interview me. So I will be on that show.
Wow. Awesome.
Probably within a couple weeks. I'm getting interviewed for that right before I leave for Balticon. So it's a very podcast heavy week. I'll be on that one, and then Mira's podcast, and then we'll be doing our podcast with Z a couple days later. So just going to be podcasting, you know, mecca, weekend mania, all that kind of stuff. So
I've got some podcast news too. Are you familiar with Adam Carolla?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. I'm going to be downloading his podcast later.
Oh, I do that every day. So I'm right there with you. I love his podcast. I listen to it all the time.
Okay, so yeah. What the hell were we talking about?
I don't know.
What am I supposed to do at this point?
Plug your crap. I don't know.
Okay, so twitter.com/ATFMB, which stands for All Things From My Brain. I also have the blog, which is All Things From My Brain, ATFMB.com. Do you see the synergy there? It's really simple. Simple, simple, simple. The serialized fiction is Evermist, ATFMB.com/EVermist. Had a lot of reviews recently on the blog. I think people are liking those. I've getting some decent comments, and people, you know, Kate Sherrod, for example, said, "Oh, your Doctor Who one. I've got to go out and buy Doctor Who." Cool.
Yes.
Works for me.
Yeah.
What else have I got going? Oh, if you're going to be at the 2010 Salute to Seniors tomorrow, I'll be there.
Well, I was going to be there. How did you know?
I was going out
to Colorado, and I was going to be there.
This is the real life gig. This is the marketing director. Yeah. This is trick or treat for seniors.
Wow.
You know how you go to a trade show and you pick up all the free stuff? Dude, they bust them in. They bust them in from like nursing homes and assisted living, and they just come in and they walk through the place with their bags and they walk up to eat every day. You don't even talk to them. They won't make eye contact with you. They just walk up to your table. They look around. What's free? What's free? Grab it, put it in their bag, and move on to the next booth.
Is there a lot of free Epsom salts?
There's free everything. I mean, I know for a fact that we're giving away lottery scratchers.
Wow.
Which are the little scraper things, you know, for lottery tickets. Which, to be honest with you, my grandmother would have loved, because she used to sit there at the table scratching those lottery tickets. Scratch, 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 scratch. So that's kind of like playing to your crowd there. But I tell you what, working a trade show is 100 times different than going to one of these cons, you know. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same concept. It's just a different industry. But I am going to be incredibly grumpy tomorrow.
I understand. I understand.
And tired.
I understand. Well, finish your plugs. I'm sorry.
I think that's pretty much it. You know, atfmb.com, twitter.com/ATF. I've actually passed the 500 mark.
I know. Congratulations. I'm languishing in the 440s. I don't know. People always complain about, like, oh, I got three. I said this word and I got four followers. That doesn't happen to me. I don't know. I don't know if I have settings weird or if I'm just not that interesting of a person, but I don't like send out a tweet and get seven followers all of a sudden. Like, it's very slow going. Although I am happy that most of the people that follow me are actual people, it seems, and people that are interesting, and I end up developing nice sort of relationships with them. So, you know, quality over quantity. I'm gonna stick with that. And why I'm 60 people behind you, I'm gonna say that it's quality. I'm really more concerned with quality, Patrick.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, I just posted on the blog on atfmb.com. You know, I was trying to post and plug the podcast to anybody uh-huh. Who might not, you know, be checking it out. And I wanted to plug the Lou Anders one, because Lou was great. I think we had a great time with Lou.
Absolutely.
And had a great time
yeah.
with us. And, you know, I wanted to kind of plug that. And one of the things that I said was that I have been blown away by the Twitter community. And how mm-hmm. it's just growing, and it seems like, you know, everybody has been really, really nice mm-hmm. and kind, and you have, you know, people who are giants like Lou Anders, who is just mm-hmm. so personable, so kind, mm-hmm. and you know, you have all these other authors. You've got Blake Charlton, who we've talked to, J.V. Jones, Diane Duane, you know, all these people that, you know, you kind of think, oh, they'll never talk to me,
mm-hmm.
and they do, and they yeah. you know, they're just they're you know, it's like, oh yeah. Duh, they're people too.
Yeah, it's fun. You know, we were talking about, like, some of the noise, you know, from Lou's house when we were recording last time, and you know, it's very human. Like, here's a guy that, I mean, he's awesome and he's a cool guy, but he's got a, you know, good amount of power and a lot of influence in the industry, and he's like, he's a human being like the rest of us. He's got day-to-day things that he deals with like everybody else. And,
yep.
But it's really been great. I've really been enjoying it. And I think we got some really cool guests coming up and hope to keep getting cool people. I've really been loving the third nerd. I mean, I love doing our little duo podcast too, but I really love having the third. Maybe we'll have to do that once in a while, where it's just the two of us, and, you know, we can ramble on for like 7 hours.
Sort of a
mini one of those right now. So
half an hour ago, we're like, oh, we gotta, let's just do, you know, real quick, and we'll finish up the podcast. And we've been talking for a half an hour, so yeah,
that's a good. Well, I guess that's a good place to stop then. So
that is a good place to stop.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
And thank you. And thank Andrew for being on. We're really sorry that he dropped out. Check out functionalnerds.com. When my work network and firewall allows me, I do updates there on nerdworthy news. So that's something to kind of keep you sated in between podcasts.
Sounds great. Sounds great. All right, everybody. We will see you next week with our guest Z of Geek Dad Hip Tracks and Hipster Please.
Yay. Bye. Hey, I held in my hands an iPad this week.
Yeah, and you didn't buy it?
It was Quinn's. I don't want a sequel that fits on their fluff, even though I love it. It's very slick. It's heavier than I thought it would be.
installment of this franchise should have never occurred.
I want to wait for a USB stick. That's the only thing I'm really holding out for is a USB port.
I think you're going to be waiting a long time.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to.
Now, Andrew, apparently you didn't read the invisible fine print in the outline notes that said that you need to bring me 12 cookies and you need to bring John authentic Irish bouzouki strings.
John DiNerito over at SF Signal is also demanding a bagels.
Oh, yeah. If, and yeah. I still owe him my bagels, too, but it's a regular, I die a little each time I see it like the ring. Sure, it comes down to if the flick succeeds, but really, who are these asking for three species? Patrick, are you an irregular yet? I'm surprised you haven't done that yet.
No, I'm not an irregular. Just dress it up and shoot. And each time we hope it's just better.
Now Transformers talk about a trilogy of terror. Have me all excited now. Have you heard of Karen Loachie?
I have not.
She did a book a couple years ago called A War Child that I really liked, and she's back now. She took a
No, 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 no. My water. Not your water. Sorry, I have cats. which is why John Anelio sucks, but I try not to hold that against him.
I'm back.
Oh, John, you're back.
Yeah, I am. Hey,
that joke never gets old.
Yeah, I know. Trilogy of Terror. Trilogy of Terror.
Trilogy of Terror. You guys have your towels with you?
Do we have our what? Our towels? No.
Yes, it's
I know it's National Towel Day or Towel Day or something.
I do not have that. Yeah,
yeah. I don't have a towel. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. All right.
Thanks, Mo. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.